Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, November 10th, 2011. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week you've heard of brewing like a monk. How about brewing as a monk? Sadaka Rajanatha, a monk at Kauai's Hindu Monastery, will join us to share some 17-year-old mead and to tell us about his job as the brewer in the Hawaiian Monastery. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is basicbrewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And we also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing video page on Facebook as well at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us. Click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you this show, and we appreciate your support, especially during the upcoming holiday season. And there is now an amazon.co.uk link on there, too. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone and Android podcast apps on their respective stores. And we're not forgetting BlackBerry users. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory now, too. And the new logbooks are here. The new logbooks are here. Those of you who've been asking when the 2012 logbooks will arrive can stop asking and start ordering. You can tell Santa to go to basicbrewingshop.com and get yours for Under the Tree. Once again, Steve did a great job laying out the book, and this year our buddy Chris Hart designed the cover. So get yours ordered soon so we can get in your stocking if you have a big stocking or under the tree. You don't have to have a huge tree. Not a big book, but it's a very useful book. Follow me last week's show on No Sparge Brewing. I brewed up a second beer for the Brew Your Own Magazine Basic Brewing Radio Collaborative Experiment on Fermenter Shapes, and I brewed, using No Sparge, what I'm calling an American Mild, which may be an oxymoron. I started with 8 gallons of water in the mash tun, and when I added a little over 11 pounds of grain, my 10-gallon cooler was almost filled to the rim, so I got a little nervous there as I was doughing in. But it worked out great. I stirred 3 or 4 times during the mash, and I wound up after the boil with about 5.5 gallons of wort at 1047. So, not too bad, I'd say. And I heard from several of you on the topic of no sparge brewing after last week's show. Joel on Twitter, or Maine Brews, that's the state Maine Brews on Twitter, said he had he did a no sparge. And one stir halfway through the mash got him from 50% to 62% efficiency. So stirring during the mash appears to be important for gravity and efficiency. And Joel also said it shaved, no sparge brewing shaved an hour off his brew day. So there you go. Corey writes in with this, "I just have to give a kudos to you fellas for introducing me to no sparge brewing. Inspired by your show, I brewed an English bitter and was surprised to get 75% efficiency, right in the range for my system where I usually get 75 to 80. It completely eliminated a step in my process, resulting in my shortest all-grain brew day ever." Corey says, "I'm looking forward to trying this on higher gravity beers to test the limitations of this technique. Next up is an English IPA. I'll report back," Corey says. Well, please do. I appreciate that update. Now, I heard from a few of you who either sent me links to videos or described your own systems being no sparge, and they all kind of went along these lines. The grain is mashed in the mash tun at a moderate thickness, kind of a normal thickness. Then after an hour, hot water is circulated through a pump from the kettle to the top of the mash, and then the wort is drained back into the kettle to make the cycle again. So the water is sort of recirculated like that. Now, this is a pretty cool method. And if you like it and it works for you, that's awesome. It's actually, keep on doing it. But it's not what Dave, the author of the article, was describing as no sparge. Dave did what I did, you know, added the grain to all of the water all at once in the mash tun, and then after the mash, drained out in one louder, one drain into the kettle at the end of the mash without sparging at all, without running more fresh water on top of the grain. That's what Dave called no sparge. So I think it's just a matter of term definition, you know, a matter of semantics, but I just wanted to clarify. And I appreciate those links because it's a cool, especially the video I saw looked really cool. Billy writes in with this, I have a question for you if you don't mind. I don't mind. Do you see any downside to mashing at a typical grist-to-water ratio, then topping up in the boil kettle? Another option would be to top up in the mash tun after the mash, then transferring it to the kettle. It seems like some of the problems that Chris mentioned would be avoided. Well, Billy, I'd assume that you'd lose a lot of efficiency if you were to just do first runnings into the kettle and then top up with water after that. It seems like you'd be leaving a lot of sugar left in the grains without, you know, having a thin mash and without sparging whatsoever. Topping up in the mash tun after the mash would be sort of a variation on batch sparging, only you wouldn't be draining out the runnings, the first runnings, before you added the sparge water. I'm not sure what the advantage of that would be, other than just mashing with a thicker mash to begin with to kind of get more control over that. Also, I'm not sure you'd gain much on time just topping off in the mash tun. You might gain a little bit because you wouldn't be waiting for those first runnings to run out before you added the water. So interesting. I hadn't thought about that. If you've done that yourself out there, I'm always open to suggestions and new information. So if you have a take on it, please let me know. I've been getting some good brewing disaster stories from you guys. One or two have been cringeworthy. Kind of thing you read it and you go, ha, yow. remember, Steve and I are planning a brewing disasters show before the end of the year to read your letters. And I'm planning on giving prizes to the best ones. So get yours in to james@basicbrewing.com or just use the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And it should be a lot of fun for us to read those. Yeesh. Even though some of them, like I said, is like, wow. okay. It's not every day that you get a letter from a Hindu monk on the Hawaiian island of Kauai offering to send you mead. So when I got the email from Sadaka Rajanatha, or Rajan, telling me of his experience as being the brewer for a monastery of 21 monks, it got my attention. I asked Rajan if he'd like to talk to me for the show. And as you'll hear, Rajan has a pretty good gig, it sounds like, brewing in paradise. And he's got a tip or two that you might find useful in your brewing as well. Well, Rajan, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking. It's noon where you are, and 5 p.m. where I am. And I warned you ahead of time that I've had a cup of half caffeinated coffee before the show. So I usually only drink coffee in the morning. So you know, this is the warning. If I seem a little edgy, that's my excuse.
Excellent.
And I hear chickens in the background. Where are you?
I'm surrounded by chickens. Now I'm sort of farther away from the main building of the monastery, in a pavilion type area to get away from the tractors and the bobcats and everything. We're a pretty active monastery, so if I was closer to the building, it wouldn't be chickens. It would be the beep noise of a machine going backwards or something.
Now, we've all heard of the book Brew.
Sorry,
you're the first monk to come on the show. You're also the first one to have live chickens, I think, in the background. So.
I'm very honored.
Now, we've interviewed Stan Hieronymus, the author of the book Brew Like a Monk. You are actually brewing as a monk because you actually are a Hindu monk. Tell us that you're on the island of Kauai in Hawaii. Tell us about the monastery. Give us some background of where you are.
Well, the monastery didn't start off on Kauai. It started in California in the 50s. And our lineage of gurus goes back about 2,000 years from India and Sri Lanka. And the founder of this monastery is a Westerner of the lineage. And basically, he went to Sri Lanka and then got initiated and came back. And then now, over 40 years or something like that, there are 21 monks from six countries, I think.
Hmm. So, tell us a bit about your background. How did you become a monk?
Well, I read a book by a monk called Autobiography of a Yogi, and you know, it's just something that sort of felt right, so I jumped right into it, and certainly didn't expect to be brewing as much as I do. In fact, I wasn't a connoisseur of wine or beer or mead or anything. Actually, I found out about mead when I first came here. I didn't know what it was. Probably like a lot of people don't know what it is. And I've been doing it ever since, and it's been about 5 years.
Of course, I know nearly nothing about the Hindu culture. Growing up in Arkansas, you know, when we talk about religious diversity, we talk about towns that have both a Baptist church and a Methodist church. So, you know, my background with the Hindu culture is not very deep. So when I got your email, I have to admit, I was kind of surprised that Hindu monks brew. Is brewing you know, the consumption of alcoholic beverages, is that a deep part of the culture?
Actually, it's not, James. Alcohol is sort of considered in India, I think, and in Hinduism, kind of extreme. And there's a lot of misconception about it, and old school thought. And I think mainly, though, it's geared towards hard alcohol. We're not allowed to drink hard alcohol, mm-hmm. just mead, wine, and beer. It's considered hard alcohol to the founder was considered. It would just kind of, it drives people to their sort of more instinctive nature, where you know you get really plastered and you could, all kinds of emotions can come out and stuff. And so as brother monks, we stick to things that aren't so alcoholic. But our mead can get is kind of potent, but we drink with each other. We don't drink alone, and it's a very kind of brotherly, wholesome thing we do together. And I guess, even though it's not normal in Hinduism, to be specific with our lineage, though, it is. Our lineage has been known to drink what's called arak, I think that's how you pronounce it, and toddy. Have you heard of toddy?
Well, I've heard of a hot toddy, but I'm not sure it's the same thing.
It's alcohol made from a palm tree, I think, and it's a certain palm tree, and they take the flower, and they sort of tie ropes around it, and eventually, since it doesn't sprout fully, a liquid, a sort of sap comes out of it, and they collect the sap and ferment it. Our lineage is known as the Nava lineage, which means master or adept, and we tend to be a little, a little unorthodox in that sense, where we do drink, and the gurus did of our lineage certainly drank hard liquor, and they were a little wild, but. But they were very, very mystical siddhars, we call them. They, yes, they drank, but...
So it seems like it's sort of everything in moderation, a kind of an attitude?
Most definitely, yes, yes. We only drink at 7 p.m., starting at 7 to 9 p.m. is sort of lights out. And on our days off, we stay up a little later, and but you know we don't get you know sloshed or anything. back really, but you know we have a good laugh because we work over 45 hours a week, so we work hard, so we like to relax at the end of the day.
Well, it sounds like a healthy attitude.
Yeah.
Now, you sent me, graciously, and I appreciate it very much, you sent me some bottles of mead. And as I open this and as I pour it, give me some background on this.
Okay, well, I sent you some mead that we made in 1994 because we don't wear T-shirts, so I couldn't support by buying a T-shirt or anything. I could definitely use a brewer's logbook, though. But I figured, you know, that would be nice and everything, but I figured to really say thank you for doing the show and putting it out for free, I would send you some 17-year-old mead.
Well, you know, that'll do.
And I didn't send you any of my beer because I didn't exactly know how to ship it or... How does that work if it gets warm and then you have to get it cold again? I didn't really want to tamper with my brew. So coming from Kauai,
yeah.
I didn't know how they would, you know, how it would react.
Well, I don't think it would be that warm, that, you know, long enough to do it, you know, irreparable harm. Maybe it might have dulled the. You know, the high notes of the flavors and aromas a bit, but you know, I get beer from several places, and you know, especially in the summertime, it spends time in hot UPS trucks or whatever. So, you know, I don't know that it would have been any more damaging probably than other beers that I've gotten other places, but no, I appreciate the mead. I've poured it. It's a dark, I'd say a dark golden, and
it's pretty clear, right?
Yeah, it's beautiful. and you sent some fancy bottles.
Well, yeah, since no one knows the truth, I sent some fancy glassware.
Yeah, hand blown.
No, I didn't. Well, I didn't want to risk. You know, I don't trust those delivery guys when they're at the end of the day. Maybe they're throwing bottles. And this is really old mead, so they're not in glass. They are in little plastic water bottles.
No, that's fine. That's probably the wise thing to do. I have gotten a couple of broken bottles in my time, so.
Okay.
And I have actually been watching out the window as an UPS guy actually bowled a box across the porch toward the front door. So prudence is wise.
That could have been 17-year-old meat in there.
Exactly. Well, it smells wonderful. It definitely smells like honey still. Mm-hmm. There is a bit of an alcohol note to it in the smell. It's sort of I would say a floral honey smell, I would think. And this honey came from bees that you guys take care of?
Well, the history of that is sort of goes back to the 70s to sort of pay for the place and, you know, make money for the bills and stuff. We started beekeeping, and we got a max count of about 2,700 hives all over the island at one point.
Wow.
And I don't know much about beekeeping, but that seems like a lot to me. But I'm not surprised because the monks are really hard workers. I just imagine they tell me stories too. You know, they would go out every day before the sun came up and make their rounds. And basically, we had a small warehouse where we processed the honey. And this went on till about 1986. And once production went up, we started making mead. And I think some of the monks sort of asked our founder, can we make some sort of can we ferment something? And he felt mead at the time was appropriate since we were doing the bees. And we would collect 55-gallon barrels of honey and come back to the monastery. And every 2 months, we would make about 65 gallons. And I think they were on the primary for 2 months, and then we would rack off into buckets. And they would sit. I don't know if we aged them that long, but right now you're drinking 1994 honey because we only have some of that. That's some of the last of it, I think. We got out of honey in the 90s. We got out of mead in the 90s and sort of went to wine. I think the mead was maybe a little too much, you know, because it was kind of harsh. Because for a 35-gallon batch, we would use up to 120 pounds of honey.
It's tasty. I like it. It's a tiny bit astringent, but there are some brown sugar notes that I notice, especially as it's warming up a bit. The honey must have been a little darker than, say, your average orange blossom honey that we get here in the continental U.S.
Mm-hmm. I was checking the brewing notes on that batch, and after 17 years, the writing and the marks and everything and the paper, it's very hard to read. And, well, we didn't have a brewer's logbook back then.
Okay. And, okay, Rajan, I get the hint. You can get it. I'll send you a logbook.
So from what I can tell, it was 108 pounds of honey for a 35-gallon our 35-gallon sort of vat, conical, steam-powered conical thing. And possibly there could have been lemons and cloves and star anise. And possibly three kinds of honey.
Wow.
1 pound cream of tartar, a half cup of yeast nutrient, a half cup of acid blend. Very simple. I don't think there's a whole lot to that batch.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly tasty. Now, you, since you are in Hawaii, it's warm there year round. Do you have any kind of a temperature control to control the temperature of the fermentation?
We do. We're very lucky, and our setup is very nice to brew in. We have basically a fermentation room that is the size of, I guess you could compare it to a two-car garage, maybe, kind of a big two-car garage.
Mm-hmm.
We've gone through several different systems of cooling. We had an air conditioner unit out the wall, and that was a little noisy, so we went to a split unit, I think, and we ended up a couple of years ago going to a portable air conditioner system, actually. And you know about those?
Yeah, I think Andy Sparks has one in his garage now, where you just plug it into the wall and you have this exhaust thing that goes out a nearby window, and it puts out the cold air.
Yeah. So I don't know if a lot of people, I don't know if people think that they would work, but we have a 13,000 BTU one, and it's set for 72. But because the room is so airtight, the room was built for fermentation, so it cools to 65 Fahrenheit.
Wow!
So it is set to 72, but the room is the ambient temperature is 65.
Wow!
And so everything is fermented at that, which we do mostly ales anyway, so that works out pretty good, I think, for the yeast.
Yeah. Now talk about your brew house. What's your setup like?
Okay, well, the monastery, the monks bought the monastery, and it was a hotel before. So we have basically I brew in the kitchen, which is a commercial kitchen, and it, you know, stainless steel everywhere, and we have what's called a range oven. It's huge, so the burners are really big, and we have, you know, any size pot. We're very fortunate to have this set up. I'm very fortunate to, as a brewer, because I can basically do if I do a 5-gallon batch, I can basically do it in about 3 hours, because, you know, you can boil 7 gallons of water in minutes. It's a really good oven stove.
Yeah.
And so, and we have next to the kitchen is our basically 2 35-gallon these vats. I wouldn't say they're conicals, because they're not. The bottoms are not shaped so that the shape like a cone,
right?
But more like it's more like a big round drum.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a drain on the bottom though, and it's steam powered. And basically, that's what the monks used to brew the mead in. And I don't think they brought it to a boil. I think it was just pasteurization temperature,
mm-hmm.
and the fermentation room. So those three rooms are basically the brewery. And when I came in and received the training to be, because I took interest in wanting to brew, I was asked if I wanted to use the 35-gallon steamer vat, and I decided not to, actually. I have a converted cooler as a mash tun, and it's just got a steel hose, and I brew with that.
So it's essentially a home brewing setup, other than the ability to heat large volumes of water fairly quickly.
Yes, and that and the fermentation room makes everything pretty easy. And I have a my grain crusher is a motor. It's got a motor on it. It's not manual. I learned backwards. I learned everything backwards, basically. I couldn't actually step into the fermentation room and make something. I had to first start from the bottom, which was everything backwards. The first thing I had to do was learn how to serve beer. And then I had to know what a kegerator was and what lines were and how to carbonate. And so I thought that was kind of, looking back on it, I thought that was kind of wild.
So who was there to train you at the time?
The monk who passed the knowledge on to me was basically the head brewer of for about 20 years. And I actually am the first one to brew all grain. So I learned that from the forums and basically from the internet. And someone on a forum mentioned this podcast, and that's actually how I started listening to this show while I brewed. And so he passed on basically everything that he knew, and then that was that. That was a couple years ago.
And then you had to take it from there, build upon that knowledge, and expand it.
Well, yeah. Since I had to learn backwards, and so basically the serving, the lines, and how all that worked, and how to carbonate. That was kind of tough, actually, how to carbonate properly, and then once I actually stepped in the fermentation room, I then had to basically learn how to ferment something before I could actually brew, because it was thought that if I don't know how to ferment something, what would be the point of actually brewing it? So basically what the monk did at the time was do the Cooper kit. So he would do. That's the only way he could basically keep up was with the no boil kind of extract in a can, you know that one.
Oh sure, yeah, the kind of the Coopers or the Mr. Beer kind of extract kits.
Right. So because it all started from I actually tried the beer and I didn't really like it. And what's wrong with beer here? And, so then I said, I don't know how to make it. So then I figured out that's what he was doing. And so basically I had to brew about 100 of those, or not brew, but ferment. It's basically only fermentation. And I basically fermented about 100 kits. So with maybe in a couple months, I would do batches of, well, maybe longer than that. I would do batches of six every week or so. And once I learned how to ferment without, you know, any kind of problem or what yeast was and how it worked and without contamination, basically I definitely wanted to know more because I didn't think that was really good enough. So that's when I started buying the grain, and we don't have a local homebrew shop, so we get it shipped here from Brewcraft in Portland. Actually, they're really nice people.
Well, actually, you know, that's it may be sort of backwards from what most people learn when they learn how to brew, but that it's probably not a bad way to learn, because fermentation is a very important part of brewing, and it's probably a few batches or maybe several batches of homebrew before most homebrewers kind of discover, you know, that after you put it in the bucket, you know, your work doesn't end.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was a, looking back on it, you know, when I was first starting, I was just kind of, you know, I want to make something, and I was impatient. But now that I look back on it, I think it was a perfect way to learn, you know. For some reason, carbonation alone was a sort of a challenge for me to really get it right, and because each one is different. You know, my stouts certainly don't carbonate just like my IPAs, and you know, the head is different. And so actually what I started doing recently was I do nitrogen and CO2 for my stouts, and I find that that's how I get the really neat look when you pour it.
Sure.
How it sort of it all comes up from the bottom.
And, right.
I think the nitrogen, I heard somewhere Guinness did 25% nitrogen or something, and 75% CO2 or something like that.
Is that the formula that you've worked out?
Well, basically, they can. I'm not a very exact brewer. I'm very relaxed, and I don't take hydrometer readings or hydrometer readings or times. But I'm not really worried about how much alcohol is in it. I basically do it just for the taste.
Mm-hmm.
And so I condition the keg on nitrogen, and then after about a month, it goes to the CO2. Now, I'm not sure, you might have some people say that, well, if the nitrogen sits on top and not in the tube that goes down, that it doesn't absorb. But I definitely notice that when they condition on nitrogen and then go to the CO2, that you get a much sort of thicker kind of creaminess to the beer.
Huh. Well, you would think that the nitrogen would infuse into the beer, into the keg, in the same manner that CO2 infuses into the beer in the keg. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, you don't, if you just let the beer naturally carbonate instead of shaking it, it's going to carbonate. I mean, the CO2 is going to work its way into the beer. So you would think that, or at least I would think that nitrogen would act in the same way that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whatever it's doing in there, it's working. That's for sure. That's
so what kind of pressure do you put the beer under with the nitrogen as you're conditioning it?
I basically set the regulator to 30 or 40 or something, pretty high.
Wow.
And I just pump the keg till the hissing stops, and it's totally full, and the top, you know, basically gets pushed up, and it's sealed. And then I take the nitrogen off. I don't keep the line on it, and it just sits basically in the fermentation room. So it conditions at 65, 30 or 40 pounds of nitrogen on it.
Wow, that's a lot.
I have to manage over 55 corny kegs, so I do inspect each one before I rack into the keg.
So what? So you don't sell the beer that you make that's just for consumption with the monks, right?
Exactly. Yes, we're not allowed to sell. A while back, when we started making mead, we talked to the state government or something like that, and basically they gave us a documentation stating that because we're not a normal household, we're sort of a commercial. We have a commercial plot, really. Everything about it is commercial. The electrical system and everything, and the plumbing. We don't exactly have to follow the normal legal limits.
Hmm.
As long as we don't sell, it's everything's pretty much okay.
Excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you brew? Do you take advantage of any of the local, you know, like the pineapples and the coconuts and things like Maori Brewing Company does, or do you stick to more sort of classic styles in brewing?
You know, I would say the monks are sort of just have a taste for the more classic styles. I've never put any kind of fruit or, you know, anything other than the German purity law rules, but not that I'm against putting fruit or anything about that, or you have to follow a certain way, or, you know, but that's just sort of, at the end of the day, that's sort of, I have to make sure that everyone's happy, and if I do make something that is not, if it doesn't get consumed, it's sort of a big loss. I guess a brewery could say the same thing. They make so much, and you know, at the end of the day, they have to sell it.
Hmm. Sure.
So, I've never had a beer with fruit in it or spices or anything like that. We don't get a whole lot of micro brews on the island. So a lot of the beers, I get the recipe off the internet, and I've never really had the actual version of it. So I just, you know, for instance, we have Deschutes. Is that how you say it?
Sure, sure. Deschutes
we have their robust porter, the Black Butte Porter. I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, that's an excellent porter.
Yeah, so we have that, and basically I brewed a clone, and I did a taste test, and we couldn't tell the difference, so I guess that means I was on the right track. That was actually my first all grain batch. Or no, my first grain was a Dunkelweizen, but
wow,
that was my second. So at that point on, actually, because of the results in the taste test, I was given full stewardship, I guess you could say, of the brewery and the budgets, and right now I'm the only brewer, and I basically have 20 thirsty brothers, and I brew for all of them.
Wow, very nice. Well, there are worse jobs to have, right?
Yeah, I love it. You know, some people might think it's crazy not using the 35-gallon vats, but I don't really want to brew something and have it more than once right now. You know, pulling the tap on the kegerator and having a different brew every time, because 5 gallons pretty much lasts about 2 or 3 days.
Wow.
So, yeah, we have a wide variety.
Well, that's excellent. That keeps you entertained because you're brewing different things all the time, and hopefully it keeps your clientele happy as well.
Yeah, I do have two taps. One tap is for the it's an 8-tap kegerator, but 4 soda, 1 white wine, 1 carbonated water, and 2 beer, and the one beer tap is strictly for the monks who, I would say they can't really, they don't like I guess flavorful beer. They like light sort of the Corona type beers. So I keep one tap with pretty much extract and one tap all grain.
Well, there's some in every crowd, right?
Yeah. But it works out, because while I do an all grain, I do an extract during the mash. So it seems to work out pretty well.
Yeah, I bet you're able to run through an extract batch in fairly short order with that kind of equipment.
Yeah. You know, there's no There's no boil over issue or something with a huge, you know, 12 or 15 gallon pot, and you know, it just sits there. I don't actually have to watch it or anything. Just a timer for the hop schedule.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm sipping more of this mead and just a little more because it's about supper time. I have an empty stomach, and you know, having the half calf cup of coffee.
Oh, that's right.
And the brown sugar notes are really coming out more, especially in the aroma. Yeah, that's very nice, and that's. And there was no brown sugar added into the recipe that you could see?
I don't think so. Maybe, let me see. Yeah, lemons, cloves, star anise. Maybe that's the star anise. That stuff is pretty spicy if you use a lot.
Oh, but these are kind of, you know, dark, you know, kind of dark, dark, heavy caramelized sugar notes. So, whatever it is, it was tasty. So cheers to the monks that that brewed the mead back in 1994. It was wonderful. And cheers to you, Rajan, for sharing it. This is wonderful. And I'm gonna share it with others who are nice to me around here in Northwest Arkansas, too.
Excellent. The honey, it could either be wild. I think it's possibly wildflower. Basically, Hawaii can have some pretty interesting seasons with the huge trees here. So whatever's in season, the bees will go for, and we must have just collected 55 gallons of just honey from several different kinds of trees. So it could be just some really wild honey.
Wow. Well, whatever it is, it's wonderful stuff. And I appreciate your sending it along. And it's been fun chatting with you. And now I can actually say that I've spoken to a brewing monk here on the show. And, you know, we've had chickens in the background.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks again to Rajan for the mead and the time. It's always good to hear of brewers going beyond what's expected of them and helping to introduce other beer lovers to better beers, especially better homebrewed beers. Don't forget to send in your brewing disaster stories. I'd like to get those in before long, because we're going to record a show before the end of the year with your stories. Sounds like a fun time. I'm looking forward to that. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy otherwise, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site, along with our Brewer's Logbook, which is now available to order. We got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Raspberry Swirl Wall Decoration and Camelback Ice Queen Hydration Pack. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we appreciate your support. Also, don't forget you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through an associate link on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.